Roman society was highly stratified. Rank, wealth, birth, and political power, these things largely determined one's place, not necessarily merit. Of course, the emperor reigned supreme. He was not just a ruler, but a patron and a father figure, and he wielded immense influence over all. And yet the system was intricate, divided, and distinct. Roman elites, for example, were divided. Some of them were politicians, while others were tax farmers and governors. And it may surprise you to learn that even former slaves could become fabulously wealthy, in some cases wealthier than many senators. And what about the masses? Was there just one giant blob of dirty, poor people in Roman cities and countrysides? Or did even the vast majority of inhabitants of the Roman world find ways to stand out against the people around them? At each level of Roman society, there are fascinating nuances and power dynamics. The system is unique and it's interesting, and we're going to talk about it on this episode of the Pax Romana podcast. Episode 42, The Roman Social Hierarchy. There are many ways in which the Roman social hierarchy stayed the same after the transition from the Republican period into the Principate. There are some ways that it was very different. We've been talking a lot about senators, sometimes about equestrians, and of course about emperors as well. Where do all of these people fit together? Who ranks above who? The fact is that the Romans were very strict about orders, what some might call classes, but that's not really the best term, the divisions between people. It might be obvious, but at the tip top of Roman society was the emperor. He was the guardian, politically, culturally, economically, of society. Now, under the Julio-Claudian emperors, that is, the emperors from Augustus to Nero, there was at least a nominal sense that the Republic was around, it just was being taken care of by the emperor. That the office of emperor was just a combination of a bunch of different Republican offices, and this needed to be done so that the Republic did not descend into civil war. Some Romans openly understood, of course, that they were in an autocratic period, not a republic anymore, but it's significant that for centuries, most emperors dared not call themselves a king or a dictator or anything like that. Rather, they used the father of the country, the first among equals, or the first citizen. The emperor was there to supervise society. It could not be left to its own, even the elites. Emperors became patrons on a grand scale, showering resources on the city of Rome and also any cities and colonies that they favored across the empire. They provided public works, financial handouts. They might even advocate for the citizens of particular cities. Patronage enabled emperors to gain public support, promote loyalty, and encourage the development of Roman culture, especially in territories which were still being pacified by Rome's legions. It quickly became the case that the emperor's persona, even for people that never met him personally, even saw him, or might not even know exactly what he looked like, nevertheless, he became essential to the social order, even to the way that people saw their own identity within the Roman world. He imparted justice. He kept the Senate from fighting one another for supremacy. And senators, for the overwhelming part, fell in line. They were more than happy to give up the opportunity to hold ultimate monopolistic power themselves in exchange for regular access to honors and status and wealth. The very first emperor, Augustus, raised senators up above the class below them, the equestrians, in some meaningful ways. One of them is that he raised the minimum wealth requirement to join the Senate to above 1 million sesterces in propertied wealth. It's an amount of money that no regular soldier or craftsman or farmer would ever see in his lifetime, or perhaps even 10 lifetimes. And that was just the minimum. As a result, the number of men eligible to join the Senate were less than just a few hundred, especially when you consider the fact that they also had to hold political office. So they had to be rich and they had to be politically involved. Senators walked around the streets of Rome, togate, with a broad purple stripe on their toga. They were the only ones allowed to wear this stripe. From Augustus onward, there were strict rules about who they could marry, the idea being that elites should marry other elites. Now, it wasn't the case that just because a senator had a male child, that that male child would automatically be a senator. That was not the case. Of course, the sons of senators had plenty of advantages. They inherited the wealth of their fathers, which made them eligible for the Senate in that way. And then, of course, with the name of their fathers, they were able to run for office and usually win. Under rare circumstances, men would rise up from outside the senatorial order on the backs of generations of their ancestors who gradually improved their station and might be finally able to then win political office and obtain the minimum wealth requirements and therefore join the Senate. But this didn't happen very often at all. In practice, the Senate largely reproduced its membership through birth. These men were the leaders of the Roman Republic, but under the Empire, they were the main legislative and administrative instruments of the emperor. What about men who had enough wealth to join the Senate, but didn't wish to or simply could not muster the votes to obtain political office? Those men typically fell into the second group of elites, just lower than the Senate. These were the equestrians. There were thousands of men in this position. They had the same aristocratic ethos as many senators. Their property requirements were lower, only about 400,000 sesterces in propertied income, so about half what the senators had to have. They also had to come from two generations of free birth. You could not have a slave as a father or former slave. Neither could you have a slave or former slave as a grandfather. Like the Senate, they got special clothing, a toga with a narrow purple stripe instead of the broad purple stripe. And it was from this group that emperors found many of their prefects and procurators. These are just different words for governors of various kinds. It was useful for emperors to use these men as direct appointees into governorships because these men knew the tax system. They were usually in touch with merchant activities and credit markets. They were very good at negotiations and networking. And if they were appointed directly rather than being appointed by the Senate, then they owed the emperor personally their allegiance. And so emperors were more likely to trust them with governorships in provinces that required regular military intervention because they were often rebellious or they were on the very borders of the empire. So places like Judea and Egypt and Britain tended to have prefects and procurators from the equestrian class rather than from the Senate. Another group of elites, but nowhere near the same tier as senators and equestrians, were decurions. Sometimes these are called curiales. Now, these would be local elites, counselors of important cities, magistrates in towns. They were the most powerful figures in local governments. These men were expected to be wealthy, although nowhere near as wealthy as senators and equestrians, perhaps about 100,000 sesterces per year in property wealth. These were the men who carried out what we might in some ways call the bureaucratic functions of the empire. That is, through their own money and wealth, they were not paid, they were expected by the imperial state to keep the roads up, to supply horses for the imperial messenger service. They were expected to keep canals clean and to, in some provinces, collect taxes. The way that that worked is the curiales would pay the taxes up front, and then it was their job to go around and collect back the amount that they had paid to the Roman state, and maybe a little bit more. Now, aside from these elite groups, there was basically everybody else. What we don't see in the Roman Empire, or indeed the Roman Republic, really, is a middle class, a group of entrepreneurs and businessmen, people who were not exorbitantly wealthy and independent, but nevertheless were able to live a fairly comfortable life. Just about everyone below the elite was a member of the masses. But even here, there was some division. It mattered, for example, whether you were born free or whether you were born a slave and later freed, or whether you were still in chains. It mattered whether you were a citizen or whether you were a non-citizen. It also mattered whether you came from the city or whether you came from the countryside. Urbanites, whether they were free or freed, had the great privilege of living off the surplus of the countryside. And it didn't matter as much whether that surplus came in the form of work or direct handout from the emperor. In some modern societies, it's a shameful thing to take welfare payments, handouts of various kind from the state. That really was not the case in the Roman world. It was a great privilege and an honor to be able to have for free what somebody else had to create through hard work. And so the urbanites of the Roman Empire enjoyed a special status against the rural, rustic peasants who lived at subsistence and had their extra produce taken by the state so that it could be redistributed to soldiers or to inhabitants of the cities. I'll say more about freedmen and slaves in a future episode, but just for now, despite the fact that former slaves were granted legally many of the same rights and privileges as citizens who were born free, it was nevertheless a reduced status. Freedmen often remained dependent upon their former masters. They could not ever enter the elite orders. In some cases, their sons and grandsons also were banned. They could not join the military. They could not marry into elite families. But there were some great advantages, especially for freedmen who had been slaves for wealthy Romans and had high education and had performed a lot of networking duties for those, say, senators and equestrians. Those slaves, when they became free, used those relationships to make money, to acquire land, and essentially to just become rich. The Book of Satire was written by one of Nero's friends in the mid to late 1st century AD, and the Satyricon speaks about wealthy freedmen. And the Satyricon says some things about wealthy freedmen. These are the words, for example, of one of the characters in the piece, a man named Trimalchio. Trimalchio says this: "As the gods willed, I became the real master of the house and came into an estate for a senator. I conceived a passion for business. I made clear 10 million in one voyage. I at once bought up all the estates which had belonged to my patron. I built a house. I bought slaves and cattle. Whatever I touched grew like a honeycomb. When I came to have more than the whole revenues of my own country, I threw up the game. I retired from active work and began to finance freedmen." That's Petronius's Satyricon. The character in this work is fictitious, but he had to be believable. In other words, some aspects of this have to be based on truth in order for the humor to work. What we see in the passage is a former slave who uses his newfound freedom, but the old connections that he made when he was a slave, to invest in some kind of maritime trade or shipping ventures. He makes a fortune doing it, and he even becomes a major landholder, a man richer than the country from which he comes. Wealthy freedmen like this had a great advantage over senators and even some equestrians, because those men had to abide by the various rules and cultural norms of Roman elites, rules that came out of a very conservative tradition and prevented such men from simply using their wealth however they wanted. They had restrictions about who they could give loans to, what kinds of interest rates they could charge, whereas wealthy freedmen had none of these. Now, most freedmen weren't wealthy like this. They dealt with stigma their entire lives that kept them below freeborn citizens. But there were at least enough cases of wealthy freedmen taking advantage of their connections and their liberty to outgain even equestrians and senators. And this was many of whom thought such freedmen were a disruption to the Roman social hierarchy. Of course, there were also slaves at the very bottom rung, but even slaves had a hierarchy among them. It was much better to work in the household than it was to work in the fields, and certainly the mines. Some slaves were educated and given privilege. Other slaves were beaten and forced to live in conditions barely fit for animals. Some slaves wanted and worked hard for their freedom. Other slaves were happy to be slaves because of all the benefits they received, and in fact, became slave owners themselves. That's right, Roman slaves could own other slaves. There are some ways in which Roman slaves were better off than, say, the African chattel slaves in the Americas and Caribbean and Western Europe. But so much of Roman society was built on the assumption of a permanent and fairly large group of slaves. And this caused them no small number of problems. In addition to being an economically inefficient system, it creates contradictions in any society, even nominally claiming to promote civilization. And interestingly, as we'll see in the next episode, there was some pushback against slavery. Never to the level of the abolitionist movements in, say, the modern United States, but nevertheless in significant ways. How did Romans treat the lowest among them? We'll talk about it in the next episode of the Pax Romana podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Pax Romana podcast. For more information, including a list of primary sources and further reading, check the show notes. Music by Red Productions and Exocore. Follow Dr. Colin Elliott on X at ProfCPE or email colin@paxromanapodcast.com. Listen to more episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or just about anywhere podcasts are available. Stay tuned for the next episode of the Pax Romana podcast.